From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. As of late Wednesday, the so-called P5 plus one talks with Iran were again continued past the already extended midnight deadline in Lucerne, Switzerland, with the New York Times reporting as of late Wednesday afternoon that as the talks resumed, an initial accord seemed potentially within reach, although with still much to work out. With a further update, RT's Daniel Bushell was in Lucerne and filed this report late Wednesday.
Iran today insisted that a deal can only be reached if all finance, banking and oil sanctions imposed by the international community are lifted. That's the sticking point because the Western powers want sanctions lifted gradually depending on how Iran proceeds with commitments. So 18 months of tortuous negotiations are up in the air. In the early hours of this morning we had heard optimism from negotiators, including Iran.
A very long day for all delegations. We have accomplished quite a bit, but people needed to get some rest and start over early in the morning.
But now even France's foreign minister has admitted the progress made is not enough as painstaking talks continue. Negotiations may be extended another day to Thursday, another European diplomatic source told news agencies just now. And for the journalists who've been following the talks here at the elite Beau Rivage Hotel behind us, it's been equally excruciating. But even if the preliminary agreement gets reached today, this won't be the end of it. Parties will have to continue the talks, aiming for a more detailed accord, they say, in 3 months' time. To recap, the international community wants to ensure Iran develops a peaceful nuclear program, but never achieves the capacity to build a nuclear bomb. In return, Iran will see painful economic sanctions lifted. Whether they'll reach that target, we hope to hear officially from EU and Iranian foreign chiefs later today.
And we have confirmation that the talks have been extended for another day. Meanwhile, a senior Iranian official called on the UN to take immediate action against the Saudi-led war on Yemen. Hossein Amir Abdollahian, Iran's deputy foreign minister for Arab and African affairs, said Wednesday that if the Saudi-led military aggression against Yemen continues, it will have dangerous repercussions for the entire Middle East. The Iranian diplomat made the remarks in a meeting with UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon on the sidelines of the Third International Humanitarian Pledging Conference for Syria in Kuwait City. That call came amid confirmation of reports that at least 29 additional persons were killed Monday in aerial bombing that struck a camp for internally displaced persons in Yemen. Those reports were confirmed by a spokesperson for the UN Secretary General, who said that local UN authorities had called on combatants to respect international and humanitarian law. This was Farhan Haq, spokesperson for Secretary General Ban Ki-moon, Tuesday.
Our humanitarian partners and local residents have confirmed that airstrikes bombarded the Al-Mazraq area of Hajar Governorate in Yemen yesterday morning, hitting a camp for internally displaced persons and surrounding civilian infrastructure. According to initial reports from the World Health Organization, these strikes killed at least 29 people and injured 41, all of whom appear to be civilians. Of the 41 people injured, 14 are children and 11 are women. Casualty figures are likely to rise as bodies are retrieved from the camp and additional injury reports are verified. The UN humanitarian coordinator in Yemen deplored yesterday's attack in the strongest terms and called on all parties to observe their solemn obligations under international humanitarian law and international human rights law at all times.
The UN High Commissioner for Human Rights warned that Yemen is on the verge of complete collapse as Saudi warplanes continue to pound Yemen for the sixth day. He also expressed concern over the fatalities caused by the airstrikes, saying that the situation in Yemen is, quote, extremely alarming, closed quote. Press TV's Sarbis Nizari has more.
Casualties keep rising and more destruction is inflicted on Yemen as Saudi Arabia and its allies continue to pound the impoverished country. Warplanes have bombed different parts of the country since the airstrikes began on Wednesday night. International aid organizations have expressed alarm over the high civilian casualties from the airstrikes. The UN Rights Chief Zaid Raad said the high number of civilian casualties over the past days is simply unacceptable, warning that Yemen is on the verge of total collapse. He said homes, hospitals, and infrastructure in several locations have been destroyed. The International Committee of the Red Cross also called for the urgent removal of obstacles to the delivery of vital medical supplies needed to treat casualties. Russia has expressed deep concern over the situation in Yemen. Iran has warned that the Saudi attacks would endanger the whole region.
The fire of war in the region from any side will drag the whole region to play with fire. We strongly object to the military solution in Yemen. We believe that the Saudi military attack against Yemen is a strategic mistake.
Riyadh and its allies say the airstrikes are against the Ansar Allah movement and popular committees and target their military positions. It says the attacks are aimed at bringing an end to Ansar Allah's control of parts of Yemen and to bring fugitive former President Abdurrabbu Mansour Hadi back to power. But analysts believe that the Saudi aggression will create a disaster in its southern neighbor.
The Saudi Arabian attacks, military attacks, are causing a major human rights disaster. They are not simply engaged in military warfare. They're bombing refugee camps. They're bombing infrastructure, homes, roads, hospitals, buildings that have no military value. So they're generating a very big disaster there.
Back in 2009, Riyadh waged another war against Yemen's Houthis. According to Human Rights Watch, there is credible evidence that during that war, Saudi Arabia used banned weapons, including cluster bombs, in Yemen's northern Saada province. The rights group is now saying that Riyadh's past use of indiscriminate weapons raised concerns that they will use the weapons again in the current war. The international rights body has also criticized the Saudi-led airstrikes for the civilian casualties they have left. Riyadh and its allies, however, have remained defiant and carry on without a UN mandate. They say the airstrikes will go ahead until the goals are achieved.
According to UNICEF, the United Nations International Children's Fund, at least 62 children have already been killed as of Wednesday, with another 30 injured during the Saudi assault on the country over the past week. UNICEF also said that the fighting is severely damaging basic health and education services, while the violence and displacement are leaving children terrified. Anna Carmo has more on this.
UNICEF says the fighting is severely damaging basic health services and education, while violence and displacement are leaving children terrified. The agency's representative in Yemen, Julian Harness, stressed that children are in desperate need of protection. Parties to the conflict should do all in their power to keep children safe, he added. UNICEF is warning that the current escalation in violence and the rapidly deteriorating humanitarian situation is exacerbating already precarious conditions for children in the country. These youngsters are reportedly facing widespread food insecurity, severe acute malnutrition, and increased rates of child recruitment. Meanwhile, UNICEF said it is continuing to work to provide essential services such as water, sanitation, and health supplies to the affected children. Anna Carmo, United Nations.
But the response on the streets of Yemen's cities to the attacks by Saudi Arabia was clear, as masses of Yemenis clogged the heart of the capital, Sana'a, and elsewhere in the country. The EU foreign policy chief, Federica Mogherini, warned about the alarming impact of the ongoing Saudi attacks on the civilian population in the country. Mogherini and EU humanitarian aid commissioner, Christos Stylianides, said in a statement Wednesday, quote, "The attacks on hospitals and medical facilities, as well as the deliberate targeting and destruction of private homes, education facilities, and basic infrastructure, cannot be tolerated," closed quote. Palestine was formally welcomed as the 123rd member of the International Criminal Court, or ICC, on Wednesday. At a ceremony in The Hague, in the Netherlands, where the court is based, the foreign minister of Palestine, Dr. Riyad Al-Malki, was presented by the ICC's second vice president with a special edition of the Rome Statute, the treaty that was adopted in July 1998, establishing the court, which entered into force in 2002. We begin with this report from Stephanie Kutrix at the United Nations.
By officially becoming a member of the International Criminal Court, Palestine has given the court jurisdiction over alleged crimes committed in the Palestinian territories since the 13th of June, 2014. Palestine signed the Rome Statute in January, accepting the court's jurisdiction. Speaking at the welcoming ceremony, Palestinian Foreign Minister Dr. Riyad Al-Malki said that in the face of what he called the great injustice committed against its people, Palestine has decided to seek justice, not vengeance.
We seek justice because it is the anchor on which a future of peace and stability can be firmly established. Palestine's decisions to become signatory to the core human rights and humanitarian law instruments, as well as the Rome Statute, should be viewed in this light. Our policy reflects a commitment to international law and universal values.
Dr. Al-Malki reiterated Palestine's pledge to cooperate with the prosecutor, judges, and the entire institution of the ICC to promote the principles and objectives of the court and the Rome Statute. He said Palestine remains one of the most important tests of the will and ability of the international community and its institutions to uphold universal values. Stephanie Kutrix, United Nations.
ICC membership enables the Palestinians to bring legal action against Israeli officials over crimes committed on Palestinian territory, including offenses committed during Tel Aviv's war on the besieged Gaza Strip last year. The Palestinian decision to join the ICC was made in January after decades of negotiations with Israel failed to put an end to Tel Aviv's policy of expanding settlements on the occupied Palestinian lands and repeated attacks. In response to the decision to join, Tel Aviv cut off more than $120 million U.S. dollars in tax funds due to the Palestinian Authority. Meanwhile, on Tuesday, the International Federation for Human Rights submitted a detailed report to the ICC, slamming Israel for war crimes and crimes against humanity during its devastating military onslaught on Gaza last summer. The Paris-based NGO, which was the first organization to gain access to the Gaza Strip following a ceasefire in August of last year, pointed in the report to examples of indiscriminate and direct attacks against civilians and civilian objects, the disproportionate use of force, as well as deliberate attacks targeting medical services during the Israeli war on Gaza, which was codenamed by the Israeli government Operation Protective Edge. RT's Harry Fear was there during the 50-day Israeli onslaught, and he filed this report.
Gaza in July and August 2014, a deadly conflict that's never been subject to a full independent investigation. I was in Gaza for RT at the time, and I saw the extent of the civilian suffering there.
We met four-year-old Shema Al-Masru. She was injured in her abdomen. She became collateral damage in a drone strike.
Aya, 11 years old, was one of those pierced by multiple pieces of shrapnel.
One hospital room and one entire family caught up in a war from which they couldn't escape.
The manager of the hospital tells me that every day the hospital is hit by shrapnel.
Now, Israel insists it was targeting Hamas and its fighters who were firing rockets. It was 50 days before a ceasefire was agreed. Nearly 2,100 Palestinians were killed. According to health officials, more than 11,000 others were injured. Some locals were left to deal with the dead bodies themselves.
And as the bloodshed goes on, Gaza's cemeteries are running out of space. This grieving family has no choice but to open up a relative's grave and bury the new body alongside.
One of Israel's tactics was to target the homes of Palestinian militants, but high-rises were leveled and whole families suffered.
These refugee camps are some of the most densely populated places on earth.
Almost everyone you speak to, quite literally, knows a relative or has themselves directly been caught up in the operation.
Israel struck over 1,000 targets, many of which are homes.
They are civilian. There are no weapons. There are no rockets, nothing.
Where are the leaders of the world who are supposed to have some sort of global governance and upholding the international law? The Palestinian people today can sum up that they are totally unprotected.
And there are those who are left behind too, children too young to take in what's happened.
I had a child here. He was all the time crying because he lost all his families. This girl, 3 years old, the Israelis demolished their house of this family. So we received the girl, her mother, two brothers with severe burns. Whole families killed under the rubble of their house.
Now, leaders of the hardline Palestinian militant groups say they're willing to go to the war crimes court themselves if it means Israel's leaders and commanders also go to answer for their actions. In London, I'm Harry Fear.
U.S. prison officials reversed course Tuesday, allowing family members of Mumia Abu-Jamal to visit the imprisoned activist in a Pennsylvania hospital. Abu-Jamal, the most well-known political prisoner in the U.S., had been moved to an intensive care unit after he was removed from prison for a medical emergency, details of which are still sketchy. Telesur's Cody Weddle has more.
The imprisoned former Black Panther, who many regard as a political prisoner, was reported to be on an insulin drip, but really very little is known about his condition or why he was hospitalized. His family was initially unable to contact him. Mumia was originally sentenced to death for the murder of a police officer, but he and his supporters have always maintained his innocence.
This is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
A little background now on Mumia Abu-Jamal. As a journalist working with the Black Panther Party in Philadelphia since the age of 16, he earned the title of the Voice of the Voiceless for his role in defending the rights of underprivileged members of his community. After a series of run-ins with the notoriously racist Philadelphia police in the 1970s, Abu-Jamal was convicted for the murder of police officer Daniel Faulkner in 1982 and subsequently sentenced to death. Supporters of Abu-Jamal cite a number of irregularities in his original trial and accused the court system of racial bias. His sentence was eventually commuted to life in prison in 2011, but the international movement that has arisen around his case maintains that Abu-Jamal is innocent and that he was targeted by Philadelphia authorities for his political views.
Mumia Abu-Jamal is one of many in the various prisons in Pennsylvania who ended up there after being arrested by Philadelphia police, and many of those, as the continuously growing list of exonerees demonstrates, were wrongfully arrested, prosecuted, convicted, and incarcerated. But those who survive arrest by the Philadelphia police may be the lucky ones, regardless of the subsequent injustice they may suffer. A new U.S. Justice Department report shows that the Philadelphia police are five times as trigger-happy as police in New York City. The report contains 49 findings and 91 recommendations for better training and community relations. But Lynn Washington, a professor of journalism at Temple University, isn't impressed, saying that over the past 25 years, the city's police department has been the subject of dozens of reports, federal consent decrees, and executive orders without the implementation and enforcement necessary to make police accountable. He spoke with Black Agenda Radio's Glenn Ford.
The issue with this report is basically the same as the issue with previous reports, and we're talking now maybe two dozen between reports and federal court consent decrees and executive orders dating back for about 25 years. The issue is not the ideas. The issue is the implementation and or enforcement of those ideas. So, yes, the mayor says that he has already appointed a 15-member commission to oversee implementation of it. But the bottom line is you have to make police accountable. And to police who engage in misconduct need to be fired. And there's a number of other things that they need to do that weren't even mentioned in that report. And it is raises some legitimate questions of the sincerity in terms of the implementation, given the fact that this mayor, Michael Nutter, has instituted stop and frisk, which since 2008 has been responsible for the harassment of nearly 1 million Black people in Philadelphia. In 2014, they stopped 200,000 people. 89% of them were Black males.
And that was 3 or 4 years into this agreement, which was supposedly overseen by a court, an agreement with the ACLU.
Well, when Nutter took over, he instituted the stop and frisk. People told him, even before, when during his candidacy, to not do this, that it would have a, shall we say, a racially disproportionate impact. And he just wouldn't have it. So he hires Charles Ramsey as his police commissioner, a police commissioner who has a record of brutality. And then they start this program that targets African Americans and Hispanics. Then the ACLU and a couple of other groups in Philadelphia sued them. And that's when you got the consent decree. Okay, well, we're not doing anything wrong, but we agreed not to do what we were doing that we claimed wasn't wrong. And now there has been 5 reports in terms of monitoring of it, and each one of those reports essentially says the police department is doing the same thing. And when you look at the panel that Obama put together to look at policing in America, who did he choose as the co-chair? But Charles Ramsey. And one of the findings of that panel was that there needs to be an end to racial profiling and stop and frisk. So if that is the sincere suggestion, why is it that you have a guy who is a serial abuser of the very wrong that you say that you want to right? It just doesn't make sense, but that's been that pattern for so long, particularly with this issue of police brutality. A few weeks ago, I wrote a piece about how President Obama's policing panel, their findings, and almost the wording of it was a mirror image of what the Kerner Commission said in terms of trying to reform abusive police practices in March of 1968 when they released that report. And I just wrote a piece that looked at the U.S. Justice Department's recent report on Philadelphia, and I compared that to findings of a Human Rights Watch report that examined Philadelphia and I think 12 other cities in 1998. And if those findings in 1998 had been implemented, there would be no need for this Justice Department review, which I hope is not a charade, but it probably will be a charade in terms of we're going to implement this.
So these reports and these consent decrees roll off the police department like water off a duck's back.
Absolutely. And just refreshing my memory on some things, I went back to 1973. And there was a court ruling, a federal court ruling in 1973, as a result of a couple of class action suits that had been filed in the late 60s in Philadelphia against police brutality, beatings, false arrests, fatal shootings. The judge at that time said, you know, police department is racist, the city officials don't do anything to try to correct this. He initiated or suggested some mild reforms in how you report this brutality or alleged brutality to internal affairs. The city's police union appealed that with the complicity of the city government at the time, which was run by the infamous Frank Rizzo. It goes all the way up to the U.S. Supreme Court. The U.S. Supreme Court says, well, no, you cannot implement these mild reforms because there's no evidence that the mayor of the city, then Frank Rizzo, is complicit in police brutality. And this is a mayor who would brag that he supports his police right or wrong, and he agrees that there needs to be force because that's what he did when he was police commissioner. And let's be clear, that ruling by the U.S. Supreme Court that made it harder for all people across the United States to challenge police brutality was written by a guy named William Rehnquist, one of the most racist guys who ever sat on that court, a man who was on that court for 30 years and never once had a black law clerk.
The Philadelphia police shoot at people on their streets at a rate of 5 times that in New York City, as well as stopping and frisking people at a rate 2 or 3 times that of New York City.
Right. And those figures, particularly the shooting figures / fatal shootings, is a figure that, again, mirrors a finding in the late 70s when the Philadelphia police shot at, hit, and killed more people than the police department in New York City. And as we all know, the police department in New York City is one of the most brutal and racist in the world. So this problem of police abuse is a problem that American society has chosen to ignore. When you look at public opinion polling, you only get just about half the people saying, well, police abuses are a problem. Excuse me? It is a problem. In 1951, a group of Americans tried to put a petition before the United Nations charging the federal government with engaging in a pattern and practice of genocide against Negroes. That's what we were called back then. And the U.S. government did everything it could to block that petition getting to the United Nations. including pulling the passports of the people who were carrying it over and sending the wife of the former president, Eleanor Roosevelt, over to talk to the United Nations because she was perceived as a friend of the Negroes to show that these people who wrote this petition were wrong. Well, one of the items that they said was an element of this genocide was police brutality. There's a line in that report or that petition that says, at one time, the classic method of lynching was the rope. Today, it's the police bullet. And they say that the police are the most overt example or the most overt force of the governmental policy to commit genocide against black Americans. 1951. And here we are in 2015, essentially talking about the same thing.
There's a lot of discussion in this report and in many other reports about training. This report says that recruits for the police department aren't trained in the use of non-lethal methods like tasers and mace and such. But if you're not trained in non-lethal methods, then you are actually being trained to shoot.
That's right. Absolutely. That is, to me, one of the more preposterous findings and assertions from that particular report, that we need to better train police. In a majority of the instances where there's a fatal shooting or a shooting that results in injury or a brutal beating, there's a civil lawsuit filed. In the way the conservatives have carved up the law, you have to allege that the ugly result was a consequence of poor training. So every time the city enters into a settlement where they pay millions, and this is tax dollars, this is not money that's coming out of a policeman's pocket, the police union's budget, or the police department's budget, they always acknowledge that we need to do better training. So, again, when you look at month after month, year after year, decade after decade, that the police department claims that it needs to improve its training, what's going to change now moving forward? At some point, somebody should say, well, hey, the money that we have been paying for training has been misspent. Somebody needs to be held accountable for it. Listen, the United States government spent billions of dollars to train the Army in Iraq. And the first time that they had to go into battle this summer, they crumbled like a bunch of chumps. So what happened to the money that was spent on that training? Should not those trainers have to pay that money back? Same way with local things dealing with Philadelphia and other police departments. So I think that's a ruse. It sounds good, but is it really substantive? Sophistry, or something sounds good, but it's absolutely illogical. And that's what we have, I think, with this training plan. Yeah, they need better training, but we need accountability. When they pull a trigger on a person who is unarmed and not causing any harm, that is murder. In Pennsylvania, the law says that you could premeditate in a split second. When it's Rashid or Rashida on the back end of the gun, oh, you premeditated this in an instant, first-degree murder, death penalty. With a police officer, always the benefit of the doubt. Well, maybe there was something that was going on. Maybe the person threw out some kind of invisible sign that made them think that they were in danger. So it's a disparity, disparate treatment, another word for discrimination, double standard of justice, which this is. Police are supposed to protect and serve. Philadelphia Police Department has an ethics code, which is only written down on paper because they never follow it. Mayor Nutter is talking out of both sides of his mouth, as he has for so long. Let me tell you about Mayor Nutter. In the mid-90s, Michael Nutter was a city councilman in Philadelphia. He saw police brutality being rampant and particularly impacting those of his district. So what he did was made an effort to resurrect the then dormant Civilian Review of Police organization in Philadelphia. He had to fight the then mayor of the city at the time, a guy named Ed Rendell, who postures himself as America's mayor. And he had to oppose the then DA, then a woman named Lynn Abraham, who loved the moniker of being the deadliest DA in America because she went for the death penalty more than any prosecutor anywhere in the United States.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.